Case number 21-4029, United States of America versus DeAndre Allen. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Schusky, you may proceed for the appellant. Thank you.
May it please the court, Catherine Adenaro Schusky on behalf of DeAndre Allen, the defendant appellant in this case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. The issue before the court today is whether the district court erred in refusing to hold a Franks hearing after DeAndre Allen made a substantial preliminary showing of an intentional false statement and that false statement called into question the integrity of the affidavit. The answer to this question is yes. A district court is required to hold a Franks hearing if the defendant makes a substantial preliminary showing of an intentional false statement and the remaining affidavit does not support probable cause. However, in cases like this, where the affidavit also contains a material omission, the court is required to consider that omitted material in its probable cause evaluation.
And what is the material omission?
How the detective connected the investigation to the Linda Lane address. And while that omitted information is somewhat unknown, it does raise questions of police misconduct. And that's why it required a hearing to flesh out how that connection was made. Because what we have here is what we would say is a lie, right? So we've proffered evidence that the false statement was that the detective learned about the Linda Lane address from Enterprise. Mr. Allen proffered an affidavit from Ms. Jones, who said she never gave that Linda Lane address to Enterprise when she rented the vehicle. We have the Enterprise rental agreement, which makes no reference to the Linda Lane address, and we've got proffered interviews from the two Enterprise employees who were working in that location on that day that Ms. Jones rented the vehicle, and they both said that the only address they would have is the one that was provided by the renter and on the rental agreement. So now we have what we would call a false statement, a lie, that the detective is saying, we learned the Linda Lane address. We ran an accurate report and determined that DeAndre Allen was associated with that address, and we began an investigation on that address. So it raises the question of how did they connect that address? Could it be that there was a warrantless search of the GPS of the vehicle? Certainly could happen. Could it be a warrantless search of DeAndre Allen's cell phone? Certainly could happen. This is information that we don't know because we weren't able to cross-examine.
But we do know, at least the affidavit says that they'd observed a vehicle or this vehicle parked in front of the Linda Lane address.
That's correct.
Why isn't that enough to show that there was a connection between between Allen and the address?
Because
and the drug dealing.
Well, that does connect to them. The question is, how did they connect that car to that address? Again, it sort of suggests, at least to me, that there was a warrantless search on the GPS of that vehicle, so that they found the location of the vehicle and began surveillance. There would certainly be a Fourth Amendment issue there if there's a warrantless search with just we have information of somebody drug dealing throughout the county, right? So there are...
I guess the way I was trying to imagine how this could have happened would have been that they saw this vehicle, and they ran the license plate, which is not wouldn't be a warrantless search of the vehicle. That would just be running the registration, and they determined that it's owned by Enterprise, and then
that is how it happened. You understand?
Yeah, and then they contact Enterprise, and they find out that an acquaintance of Allen has rented it.
Well, this is where it falls apart, right? So law enforcement does, they get the CI who says, this guy Bugatti is dealing drugs throughout the county, he's driving, a black truck or this new SUV, and he gives the license plate number. They then run the license plate number, which they can certainly do, and they connect it to Enterprise. It's a Enterprise rental vehicle. Here's where it all falls apart, right? Because then the detective says, so then we go to Enterprise, and we find out that Tiffany Jones rented this vehicle, and she provided the address of Linda Lane. So then they run an accurate report, and they connect it to Allen, and then they begin the investigation. But we know that's not what happened, because Enterprise is saying they don't have that address, and that Tiffany Jones is saying,
right, I guess what I'm thinking may have happened was that they actually saw the car at the Linda Lane address, and then they contacted Enterprise, and I don't discount the fact that they. It seems to me there may have been a misstatement in this affidavit. There seems to be some evidence of that, but is that still enough to warrant this? You know, suppression. Was there not enough in this affidavit otherwise to link it up so that they could do the search?
Well, certainly our argument is no, right?
Because yeah.
And the problem is it's concerning that the whole purpose of the exclusionary rule, right, is to protect against police misconduct. And here when we've got suggestions that there's a reasonable inference that there may be misconduct here, we don't even get a hearing. So this is what all Mr. Allen is asking for, is a hearing on this where he can...
But it has to be a material misstatement to get the hearing, right?
And I believe it is, right? Because it raises question of police misconduct. So what else is tainted by the officer's lie, right? Does this flow into something else? And that's what the hearing would flesh out. And so even if we get a hearing and Detective Griffiths gets on the stand and testifies consistent with the affidavit, because I would expect he would, the government's doubled down on that in their pleadings, right? Mr. Allen should still have the opportunity to present Ms. Jones, the two Enterprise employees, so that the court can make a credibility determination. Yes, the court believes Detective Griffiths and finds him credible, and he can explain how that address really occurred, right? But the court didn't even do that, right? The court wasn't able to observe these other witnesses and observe Detective Griffiths and make a credibility determination once she saw them testify live. So that, I think, was the error, right? That the court was jumped to probable cause, struck, so says, first, there's no false statement, which we think is a clear error. But even if there is a false statement, we're just striking that one statement and we're going to find the rest is fine. But the court wasn't able to perform its official duty, which is to consider the material omission, which we're arguing is how the law enforcement connected that address. If there was something that was unlawful, the court must consider that in determining whether the remaining affidavit supports probable cause. The government, I'll just make a note briefly, raises for the first time on appeal good faith. Certainly we're arguing false statement, in which case the good faith would not apply. But also, they never raised this below, so this is not something, if the court were wanting to get there, we would ask that this be remanded for the district court to hear the arguments in this in the first instance. Franks versus Delaware talks about when the Fourth Amendment demands a factual showing of sufficient facts to comprise probable cause, it's the obvious assumption that there will be a truthful showing. Here we've got not only just the evidence of a false statement, but that false statement, once you strike that, reveals an omission, right? How did they connect? Now, maybe if the affidavit made no mention of how they connected the address, it wasn't a false statement, maybe we would be in a different posture, right, about whether there should be a hearing, right? But because there was a statement about how it was connected and that statement was false, it raises the question about whether there was some sort of misconduct and a hearing was required.
Well, doesn't the Accurate, running of the Accurate, which also tied your client to that address, independently tie him to the address?
Well, they ran the Accurate report on that address. So I do agree that the Accurate report would connect DeAndre Allen to the address, but the question is how did they first get to that address to run the Accurate report to begin with? And that's where we are concerned that the misconduct took place, right? So because if they didn't learn the address from Enterprise, they learned it from somewhere else. Again, perhaps the warrantless search of the GPS of the vehicle. It was at that point that once they got the address that they ran the Accurate report and connected Mr. Allen.
So is that a Franks issue or is that potentially a suppression issue down the line?
Well, we need the Franks hearing to determine what the material, what how did, the only person who can testify about how that address got connected is Detective Griffiths, right? And what he put in the affidavit isn't true. So now we need the Franks hearing to find out what really happened before we can move to suppress if there's some other Fourth Amendment violation. We would ask the court to find that the district court erred in finding there was no substantial preliminary showing of a false statement and erred in refusing to hold a hearing. We would ask the court to vacate the denial of the suppression and remand for a hearing. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Jessica.
May it please the court, Segev Phillips on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the district court correctly noted that the court below had a substantial basis to find a reasonable probability that evidence would be found at the Linda Lane address, irrespective of how the officer got the information from Enterprise. The defense here today argues that the materiality that's relevant for the Franks hearing is that it may be material to show that there may be some other misconduct down the road. That's not the test.
I think the claim is if there hadn't been this false statement, they would never have known about the address to begin with.
Your Honors, that is the claim. That's not why it's material. If you strip how they learned of the address from the affidavit.
So what you're saying is that there's plenty there to support probable cause to show a nexus.
Yes.
And that's certainly a very legitimate point. But the concern is if all of that is sort of built upstairs over a vacant lot, in other words, they never would have known that they needed to even be looking for a nexus to this place but for the misstatement of how they got the address of the place to begin with.
So Your Honor,
why is that not material?
Well, it's not material. There are a million explanations for how they could have possibly come up with this address. Just as several examples, one is that they called Enterprise centrally and that Enterprise may have their own public records, because we do know that, in fact, Ms. Jones was connected to this address. Her affidavit says that she signed a lease there and had utilities there. Another possible explanation is that they drove by and saw the vehicles, as Your Honor pointed out. How it came to the relief when you look at a possible misstatement is you just strike it and see if there's still probable cause. What she's suggesting today is that the materiality of this statement is not because it dooms the rest of the affidavit.
What you're really saying is that the insufficiency at issue here is insufficiency of what the defendant had to show in order to get a Franks hearing at all, not insufficiency of what's in the affidavit to support probable cause that there's a nexus between the vehicle and DeAndre Allen and the house.
So that's right, Your Honor. The defense has raised two arguments, and the government's responded to them. One is the Franks hearing question, and the other is whether there's a sufficient nexus separately. We do believe those are related. If Your Honor look at the Franks requirements, I know it's often spelled out in two requirements, but maybe it's easier to think about it as three. One is that there is a preliminary showing of a falsehood or misstatement. The next, and that's part of that, would be whether or not there's a substantial showing of that statement was made knowingly, intentionally, or with reckless disregard for the truth. And then the third is that there is that statement is material to the probable cause hearing. We've acknowledged in our brief that there arguably prima facie evidence to satisfy the first, that is a potential misstatement of this, but there was no evidence proffered about knowing or intentionality other than in their reply brief, the circular logic that because it was false and they couldn't think of an explanation, it must be knowing or intentional. And that can't be the test for it. There has to be more. And then the third point they don't satisfy is the materiality. If we strike out this statement, there is a ton to go from. Mr. Allen was a known drug dealer. The accurate report ties him to that house. The vehicle that the confidential informant, who was proved to be reliable, said was the one that the drug dealing was happening from, was at that location. They then showed the picture of Mr. Allen to the CI, who identified him as, yes, that is the individual that I identified as that. On top of that, when they did the control buy, and this might be the most important thing, when they do the control buy, they call, they're watching the house. Shortly thereafter, and this is all in the affidavit in the four corners, the vehicle leaves from that house to go directly to the buy. That, virtually on its own, is probable cause to believe that that house possessed evidence of drug trafficking, and on its own would have been a sufficient basis to that.
What was the sequence of events that, in terms of when they contacted Enterprise, was that after the drug buy had occurred?
No, Your Honor. So the first thing that happened was the CI came in and identified that I've been dealing with this individual named Bugatti, who's used to use a black pickup truck and now is using a silver SUV with the license plate GMC 4021. They ran that license plate. They identified Enterprise. The affidavit says they then contacted Enterprise, who pointed out.
So the affidavit is directing the sequence of events is they don't actually get to, as far as we can tell from the affidavit, they didn't get to the Linda Avenue address until after they had, the CI had not, there's nothing in there saying the CI had seen the car at the Linda Avenue address.
That's correct, Your Honor. The CI said he was selling through various times
He'd seen this car out and about town, and then they contact Enterprise, and then they're alleging that they got the address from Enterprise and then showed up at Linda and saw the transaction when they did the control buy of him walking out of the Linda address.
Yeah, and had they stopped there, this argument might be closed, sir, and not continued on to search into the Linda Lane address. But the Linda Lane address then tied into the defendant, Mr. Allen, who was a known drug dealer both by convictions and by the detectives that were involved here. He also went back and tied Mr. Allen with the CI to confirm that, and then went further and did this drug buy where he literally leaves that location, and that was within 48 hours of when the affidavit was signed and when the search warrant was.
I guess it seems to me. I think your argument is that there's enough probable cause excising the Enterprise information from the affidavit to enough information here to support probable cause in the affidavit for the search. And I guess I'm wondering, is there something, a different test than for a Franks hearing than that? I mean, because I think counsel for the other side is saying that because you have this, it looks like it may be a false statement about Enterprise, that allows them to have a hearing to determine exactly what the facts were for how they determined that this address was the correct address. And so I'm just, is there anything in the case law saying that this is not really a different test for a Franks hearing than you would have for determining whether there's probable cause in the affidavit? That's a long-winded answer. And I don't know if you understand it or not, but I'm trying to kind of think through the analysis here.
Yeah, I think I do, Your Honor. If I misunderstand, please clarify. The test is a little bit different in that this isn't even de novo review for a Franks hearing. It's abuse of discretion because, so we're going even further. The judge determined that there wasn't a substantial showing of an intentional, knowing, or reckless falsehood. And alternatively, she said, even if you prove this, even if the officer comes in and says, you know what, I lied. You're right, I lied. On its own, and we were to strike that, there would be sufficient probable cause. So it's not material. And so
the materiality element for a Franks hearing looks at, you simply strike out whatever the material is that's objectionable. And if you have probable cause in the affidavit, you don't need a Franks hearing.
That's right, Your Honor. And to respond to defense's argument today, appellant's argument today, it's certainly not that this may lead to some speculative finding that of some other Fourth Amendment violation that you theorize could happen. Otherwise, we'll have a hearing on every single case because any defendant can speculate as to what caused a misstatement to be made to the extent that it is a misstatement.
Does it matter that the reason that, because the other thing that ties the defendant DeAndre Allen based upon the affidavit to the house is the accurate search, which specifically tied him to the house. Does it matter that the way that, or the reason that they ran that accurant database search to begin with was based upon this false information or mistaken information that Tiffany Jones, or I might be getting the name wrong, but that this young woman had given the information to Enterprise that that was her address.
No, it does not matter.
And why not?
Well, the way it's dealt with under case law would be to strike just the portion of how it was given. So unless it was fruit of the poisonous tree, which there is no evidence, there's for the first time there's speculation today that that's how it was. No, however they discovered the vehicle there, the vehicle is tied to that house. They would have then run the search on the house. I mean, the cause for that accurate search was both because that was the information given from Enterprise, but also because they actually saw the vehicle parked there. Your Honors, for the reasons set forth in the government's brief, because the source was reliable, identified Mr. Allen as a heroin trafficker, identified the specific vehicle. Allen sold drugs to the informant, and that deal was the way it was progressed. They were watching. A call was made shortly thereafter. He leaves the house. He delivers the amount of drugs that was in the deal. For all of these reasons, there is probable cause to establish the nexus between the Linda Lane address and drug trafficking. And for all those reasons and those set forth in the government's brief, we ask this court to affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
The government talks about the Franks standard. Judge Bush asked about this. The standard is certainly that you just strike the false statement and then you review the additional remaining to determine whether there's probable cause. However, this is a unique circumstance, right? Because that false statement reveals a whole about how the investigation led to that address. So then there becomes a question, and the government talks about speculation, but it's not speculation when it's specifically related to the false statement that's in the affidavit, right?
What about his point that you've not come forward with a substantial, or arguably you haven't come forward with a substantial showing that the misrepresentation was intentional or knowing or reckless? Where is the substantial showing of that?
I think that's in the nature of the statement. It couldn't be anything other than intentional, right? The detective says, I got this information from Enterprise. Either that's true or not true.
Why couldn't it be a mistake? Why couldn't, in the midst of doing an investigation, he's getting information from all kinds of different ways, and he thought he got it from her, but he actually got it from someplace else, when you say it has to be that way?
There's no way for me to prove how he got it, right? All I know is that what his statement was I got it from Enterprise. We established that it wasn't from Enterprise. The government doubles down on the pleadings to say he got it from Enterprise. They have stuck with that statement. Detective Griffith has stuck with that statement. So it's not that it was a mistake, right? The government doesn't say, well, he really got it from somewhere else, but it really doesn't matter. What they've said is, no, we got it from Enterprise, right? So that's an intentional statement. I don't think there's an argument that could have been a mistake, right? He said he ran the license plate, was referred to Enterprise, went and had an interview with Enterprise, and that's when he ran the accurate report. It's hard to imagine how he would have been mistaken about how he gotten that. I will admit...
Suppose the affidavit to begin with had not had that statement about Enterprise. Do you think it would have been a sufficient affidavit to establish probable cause?
I think that would have been an interesting situation, because if there's no false statement and we don't know how he got there, we would have a hard time proving that there was a material omission, right? Because he made a false statement and that omission is related to that false statement, there then becomes a question about how much it taints the rest of this affidavit. I will say that DeAndre Allen, in the motion to suppress, also asked for information related to the CI, because he disputes that this one, the single drug transaction actually took place. The court said, nope, you don't have to turn that over. So he's being undercut at every way, but he can't make any more of a showing than he already has. He just doesn't have the information. The only person that has this information is Detective Griffiths, right? He's provided the information he can from the renter, from Enterprise, from the Enterprise employees. I agree that it has a heavy burden, as this court has said, to get a Franks hearing, but it's not an impossible burden. And that's where the court has put us, right? We cannot produce any more information without going to the source. And the court has determined for some reason that we cannot. And I don't think that is a fair showing, especially. And so I'll go back to, I'll go back to the question. If there is no information that offers a reasonable inference of some sort of misconduct or something like this false statement and this missing information about how we got here, then there's probably not enough for a hearing. But that's not what we have here. On the issue of nexus, I will just say there is a different question that we presented, sort of two arguments in the brief, and I, in hindsight, should have organized them perhaps differently. The court doesn't have to get to the constitutional question of nexus. We've made the argument, we preserved it, we think that there's an insufficient nexus. However, if the court finds that there is a false statement and that there was omitted information that the court should have considered when determining whether there was probable cause, it should go back for a hearing for the court to do the probable cause analysis with that additional information after the hearing. Unless the court has any other questions, we would just ask it reverse. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for both sides, and we will take the case under submission.